You know that I talk on a fairly regular basis about issues revolving around the Pentagon and Pentagon contracting and the contracting community. A short time ago, I had a guest, and I apologize to that guest who commended to me the op-ed piece from the New York Times of December 13th called What Ike Got Right, because I do not remember the name of that guest, and my apologies to you, whoever, sir or madam, you were. But I appreciate you commending that to me. The op-ed was by James Ledbetter, and the first paragraph says, last week the National Archives released a trove of drafts and notes that shed new light on President Dwight D. Eisenhower's farewell address, in which he warned America about the military-industrial complex. If you've paid attention to these issues, you're familiar with at least the tenor and content of the speech, if not the actual words contained in the speech. And James Ledbetter, in addition to writing this op-ed in the Times, is author of the book Unwarranted Influence, Dwight D. Eisenhower and the Military-Industrial Complex. And he's my guest on In Depth with Francis Rose for this half hour. Thank you for being on the program, James. It's nice to talk to you.
My pleasure, Francis. Nice to be here.
What was the impetus for this for you? What got you interested in this other than the release of this information from the archives?
Well, this is actually a book I've worked on for the last 2.5 years, and I think that this speech, the Eisenhower farewell speech delivered 50 years ago this Monday, has always stuck in my head for a variety of reasons, but I think that the most important is that it's very rare for the President of the United States, who is, after all, the Commander-in-Chief, to take a position that is either substantively anti-military or could be perceived as anti-military. In most cases, presidents are praising American troops and American military strength, all of which is appropriate. But here was the five-star general, the man who commandeered perhaps the largest military force in the history of mankind in order to win World War II, telling us at the end of 8 years as president that there was a problem with the military and the military, what he called the military-industrial complex. And that is just such a rare circumstance, so singular in American history that it's always stuck with me, and so I decided to sort of dig into the origins of that speech and to trace the idea of a military-industrial complex from its roots, which really precede the speech by several decades, to how the concept evolved in the 50 years since Eisenhower delivered the address.
You're right, I think, about the pedigree of the person giving the speech related to the content. It wasn't just the content itself. As I read this op-ed that you wrote and considered the speech, my first thought was, where did this speech go? He gave it to January 17th, 1961, and then other than kind of existing on the periphery, people didn't pay a lot of attention to it, it doesn't seem, until just the last couple of months.
Well, I think it's gone through phases. I think that that you're absolutely right. When the speech was first given, you have to remember, the country had elected John Kennedy to be president, who was the youngest president at the time ever elected. He was dynamic. He was charismatic. He was bringing in a new wave of people and a new way of thinking about government. Eisenhower, by contrast, had been in power for 8 years, was not in the best of health. He'd had a heart attack and a stroke. His public speaking skills were greatly diminished, never that great to begin with, and greatly diminished. And I think a lot of people just sort of shrugged and let it go. However, over the next several years, particularly as the United States began its involvement in the Vietnam War, starting really in 65, but kind of peaking in the late 60s, early 70s, a lot of people began to feel that Pentagon spending had gotten out of control, and that one of the major factors for it becoming out of control was the fact that so many companies were involved in the contracting process with a profit motive. And this is at the heart of what he called the military-industrial complex. The idea that public policy is somehow being merged with profit-seeking corporations will create a situation where spending takes on its own momentum, its own dynamic, that we, and in its extreme, it takes the form of, say, Congress approving planes that the military doesn't even ask for, this sort of thing. And so there was actually in the late 60s and early 70s a great deal of concern about the military-industrial complex. I think it went away to a large degree after the end of the Cold War, but I think in the last few years, the prolonged activity in Iraq and Afghanistan has caused a lot of people again to re-examine this. And if you look on YouTube, for example, where you can watch the Eisenhower farewell address, there's well more than 500,000 views of people who've gone and watched the original televised version. So I think that there's been sort of a resurgence in our concern, and part of that is budgetary, and part of it has to do with military.
I think your point is great. I think that a lot of the discussion that I've seen, especially in Washington over the past 6 months. Well, essentially, since Secretary Gates went to the Eisenhower Library, ironically enough, to talk about reshaping the Pentagon,
right,
has revolved around what exactly do we want the military's footprint to be. It's been almost as much about that as I think it's been about the money.
Oh, I think you're right. And this is very central to the Eisenhower speech itself. You know, he talked about this conjunction of the military with private industry as having an economic aspect, a political aspect, and he said even a spiritual aspect, which is kind of a difficult idea to get your head around. But I think what he was talking about is that the Cold War, and remember, he was really at the height of the Cold War tensions, that it had created an atmosphere of fear, of mistrust, and of kind of arming for arming's sake, and that you know, most of us have grown up in an America with a permanent war industry that was simply not known to our grandparents and their predecessors. America typically would arm itself during times of war and disarm itself during times of less conflict, and that changed. And the challenge that I think Eisenhower put to us in this farewell address is, can we conceive of and then produce a society where that constant sense of fear, that constant sense of having to throw money to we hope, increase national security, but never quite being able to measure it, can we do that? It's a profound challenge, and again, one that I think, you know, most presidents would hesitate to even offer up because it is such a difficult problem.
The money element might be what drives people to see President Eisenhower's point. You write in your op-ed, which, by the way, I'm going to link up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon so anybody can read it that wants to. You wrote, a strong believer in a balanced budget, Eisenhower in his farewell address also told Americans, quote, avoid the impulse to live only for today, plundering for our own ease and convenience the precious resources of tomorrow. That is a very eloquent way of crystallizing an argument that's being made in now in all quarters, not just
right.
On one side of the political aisle or the other. A couple of big news stories today about comments made by Grover Norquist, who is not one that people would expect would come down on the side of shrinking military or moving out of a war situation. And he's saying we really need to reconsider what's going on, what we're doing in Afghanistan. That making big news. But his argument is almost exclusively the money. Is this how we really want to be spending the money that we have to spend? There is finally a sense, I think, that there is a limited amount of money to plow into whatever it is that we decide we're going to plow it into.
I think this is a great point, Francis. And one of the things that I found in researching this book is that the way that Eisenhower thought about the military budget, you know, he was insistent during the 1950s that there had to be some kind of limit to how much we were going to spend on so-called security. Now, this was a controversial view. His own Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, took the opposite view, which is that, you know, there should be no limit. There should be no end to what America is willing to spend on national security, because after all, the Soviets, we were told, would spend whatever it took. And Eisenhower's feeling was, well, of course, if you want to turn the society into what he called a garrison state, you could basically have the military run the society, right? You could hook the entire economy up to the military state, as was more or less done during World War II and run it that way. Eisenhower thought that was an abomination. It was the equivalent of destroying democracy in order to save it, and he believed that there had to be some point at which enough spending was enough. Well, what he identified as a dynamic with military spending, a lot of people now feel is true for government spending as a whole. That the there has to be some upper limit, and then therefore, if everything is on the table in terms of what to cut, and we need to make big cuts, well, you know, the military's got to be right up there since it is one of the largest expenditures every single year, whether we are theoretically at war or theoretically at peace.
That's an interesting parallel to where we stand today, James, and I'd like to think about and talk about other parallels that exist between Eisenhower's time when he made this speech and where we find ourselves today when we come back from the break on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. My guest is James Ledbetter. He is author of the book Unwarranted Influence, Dwight D. Eisenhower and the Military-Industrial Complex. You can get it on Amazon now. We'll have a link for you to do that later this afternoon at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. More conversation with James Ledbetter when the program continues.
Video teleconferencing solutions are changing the way people communicate by breaking down walls and enabling face-to-face communication, regardless of distance or environment. Tanberg, now a part of Cisco, developed Break Down the Walls to provide a window into the ways government, education, and healthcare organizations are using VTC solutions to help them operate more effectively and efficiently, and the ways video solutions can be used to address challenges facing public sector organizations today. Learn more at BreakDownTheWalls.com. Who did the FAA select to develop its next-generation air traffic management system to manage 87,000 flights every day? ITT. ITT Defense has a single focus: deliver innovative technology solutions to governments worldwide. From next-generation imaging that integrates space, airborne, ground, and soldier sensors to energy systems that disrupt the enemy, ITT has the technology and experience to address the most pressing mission challenges. ITT Defense, doing essential things in extraordinary ways. Visit them at defense.itt.com.
A persistent problem facing all government agencies today is disposal of their confidential documents or other sensitive material. The best solution is turning your confidential files into energy. That's right, energy. Get clean and go green with Energy Recovery Operations on Aberdeen Proving Ground in Edgewood, Maryland. Since 1988, Energy Recovery has destroyed all sorts of government confidential records and magnetic media while producing energy. There is complete destruction. Do the green thing. Turn your government confidential records into energy. Go to EnergyRecoveryOnline.com or call 410-679-6200. Your mission is possible. Stop identity theft. Burn your government-sensitive records. Log on to EnergyRecoveryOnline.com or call 410-679-6200. That's EnergyRecoveryOnline.com. This message will self-destruct in 3 seconds. 3, 2, 1.
Hey there, I'm Christopher Dorabeck. Here's what we're working on for the Dorabeck Insider this afternoon. You know the Sony PlayStation, right? Well, how many PlayStation video gaming consoles would it take to create the power of a supercomputer? We'll talk to Defense Department engineers who've done it. We'll find out how and why. And the SBA, they've redesigned their website. They're looking to provide information and build community. We'll find out how they're doing that this afternoon, 3 to 7, on the Dorabeck Insider. It's right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest is James Ledbetter. He's author of the book Unwarranted Influence, Dwight D. Eisenhower and the Military-Industrial Complex. And I first became aware of his work through the recommendation of one of my guests talking about the op-ed, James, that you wrote called What Ike Got Right. It was in the New York Times on December 13th of last year. And I cited the quote that President Eisenhower gave in this speech, the anniversary of which we'll be observing in just a couple of days, where he said, avoid the impulse to live only for today, plundering for our own ease and convenience the precious resources of tomorrow. That's how a lot of people look at the situation that we find ourselves in today. And it caused me to think about the parallels between yesterday and today. And I think sometimes we get wrapped up in the fervor of what's going on today and don't always think about the fact that maybe we've thought about these things or dealt with these things before, whatever those things may be. Were there parallels in Eisenhower's time when he gave this speech to what we're dealing with as a country today?
Absolutely. And I think one of the really important things to keep in mind, and it's sort of hard for those of us who have grown up with the party politics situation that we have right now, but when Eisenhower was leaving office, and really throughout his second term, this is the late 1950s, it was the Democrats who were arguing for greater military spending. What happened in the late 50s, you had the Sputnik satellite launch in 1957, which caused a lot of people to think, oh my gosh, we have fallen behind the Soviet Union in terms of our technical capabilities. We have we're going to fall behind in the building of outer space weapons, and simultaneously the release of something called the Gaither Report, which was a supposedly confidential assessment of U.S. and Soviet military strength, and it concluded that the United States was about to fall behind or had already fallen behind the Soviet Union in terms of the size of its nuclear arsenal. So the Democratic Party made a big deal about this, and it was a major issue in the 1960 political campaign. They were calling for greater military spending, and to some degree, the Republican Party was trying to hold down spending, but there were Republicans who also wanted, for political reasons, largely, to increase the amount of spending. Now, Eisenhower was in a difficult situation because he knew that this assessment of Soviet forces was incorrect, and he knew it because we had at that point the U-2 spy plane that was getting real on the ground data. But of course, it was top secret, and he couldn't disclose it. So there was a kind of tying of his hands that I think is one of the reasons why he got so frustrated with the military. And I think the parallel that we see with today has to do not only with military spending, although I think that is also the case, but the political popularity of some of these programs on which we spend a great deal of money makes it all but impossible for even fair-minded people in public life to call for a major overhaul. And obviously Social Security falls into this category. Now, I'm not saying that we need to make drastic cuts in Social Security, but I think everyone who looks at entitlement spending realizes that it is unsustainable at its current levels of growth. And if you don't believe me, you can look at the IMF data and some of the ratings agencies that rate American debt. We are on a path toward a debt that will cripple us. But who has the courage? Who has the leadership ability to sort of stand up and have the discussion in which we can make those decisions rationally and fairly? And that, I think, is a terrific parallel to the situation that Eisenhower found himself in, mostly to do with this issue of military spending as opposed to the budget as a whole. Though Eisenhower was one of the last presidents who ever put forward a budget that was actually smaller than the year before. We haven't seen much of that in the last several decades.
No, we certainly have. Well, the last several years in particular, we haven't even seen budgets, really. We've just seen continuing resolutions and omnibus bills and so on. So he even had that going for him on top of the fact that they were smaller, if that's what people believe the policy should be. Let's go back to something that you talked about in the first part of our conversation, and that is the idea that the power of the purse obviously comes from Congress, the way our system is set up, and the idea that someone is perpetuating some of these things. You mentioned the problem with weapon systems that, airplanes, for example, that the Pentagon doesn't want and specifically tells Congress they don't want them. Do you have confidence as a researcher and observer of these issues that we may finally be at the point where some, probably not all, we'll probably never get to all, but some members of Congress will say, you know what, it would be great to have these X number of jobs in my district or in my state, but at some point we have to say enough?
Francis, this is a great question, and I think the answer is there have long been individual members of Congress who have taken on the question of military spending and the efficiency of military spending with great fervor. One of the ones who I write about in the book, who really came to prominence in the 60s and then the 70s, was William Proxmire, who also broadened his criticism of military inefficiency to a sort of broader sense that there was too much wasteful government spending in general. Used to give out the Golden Fleece Awards, and you remember those?
I remember those, yes.
Yeah, but he really started with a concern about the military. So another one who I write about in the book was Senator Fulbright, who was an early opponent of the Vietnam War and held a lot of hearings and in fact wrote a book having to do with all the different tentacles that the military was getting its hands into different parts of the economy. It was very concerned that excessive military spending actually hindered the economy, because remember, it's usually the same few firms who are getting the bulk of the military contracts, and therefore hindering competition, making it much more difficult for smaller players to come into fruition. So, and then in the 80s and 90s, Senator John McCain has been very hard on what we might call the military-industrial complex. And today, I hear some very interesting things from Tom Coburn. There is, I think, a consciousness among a few players in Congress that this is an issue. It has never really reached critical mass, and the evidence for that is that we're, you know, depending on how you define it, we're now spending something like $1 trillion a year on the military, and the rise has been inexorable. It has continued to rise even in periods where we thought it was going to decline. So, for example, after the Vietnam War was over, there were a lot of people who thought, well, we're decommissioning tens, if not hundreds of thousands of troops. We're no longer having to spend the money on the bombs and the planes. It never really happened. At the end of the Cold War, there was a lot of discussion about a peace dividend and cuts to the military budget, and there were some cuts that were made here and there. But what happened after September 11th? Suddenly, that spending starts up again. To say nothing of the two wars that we're currently fighting, and so there is this question of: are we in control of this spending, or is it a kind of self-perpetuating machine? And that was at the heart of Eisenhower's speech.
James Ledbetter, one last question. There's been a lot of conversation over the last couple of weeks about the tenor of discussion of all different kinds of things that are wrapped around political points. How do you feel about the tenor of the conversation about where we are when it comes to defense spending?
That's a good question. I think that I have not seen this area of discussion become the most rancorous. I think the rancor tends to be around other, perhaps more explosive issues. Gun control comes to mind. Certainly abortion comes to mind. That's where you often see a flirtation with what I think many people would say is sort of extremist language. We could, however, come to that. I think that certainly military spending is at the heart of a lot of people's jobs. It's at the heart of what a lot of members of Congress think is their, you know, number one or certainly very high duty to their constituents and their local economies. So I think the fervor with which people are attached to military spending has the potential to be a source of less than civil rhetoric. But I don't think, since the Vietnam period, I wouldn't say that it is the number one issue that causes people to sort of lose their civil heads.
James Ledbetter's book is Unwarranted Influence, Dwight D. Eisenhower and the Military-Industrial Complex. Pleasure to talk to you, James. Thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure, Francis.